This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is white South African playwright Ethel Fugard, whose work has been acclaimed in America for its portrayal of the emotional and psychological consequences of the apartheid system. As a playwright, actor, and director, Fugard has defied his country's white supremacist system. When he co-starred in his 1961 play, The Blood Knot, with black actor Zakes Mokhai, they became the first black and white actors in South African history to share a stage. Soon after, Fugard was approached by a group of black actors seeking his help to start a company. Together they formed the Serpent Players. The company was frequently harassed by the authorities. A few members were imprisoned. Fugard's reputation for defiance spread, and in 1967 the government revoked his passport. It was restored 4 years later. Now Fugard comes to America to participate in the staging of his plays. Sizwe Banzwe is Dead, A Lesson from Aloes, and Master Harold and the Boys are some of his plays that have been produced in America. In 1985, the Yale Repertory Theater staged a 25th anniversary production of The Blood Knot, reuniting Fugard and Mokhai in the roles they originated. This production opened on Broadway at the end of that year. Fugard's plays are very popular in America, where they've won many awards. I asked Ethel Fugard why he remains in South Africa, where he lives under the apartheid system he opposes.
I suppose it's a question of my continued existence as a writer. I just couldn't see myself writing about any other place or any other time. I have on occasions in the past described myself as a regional writer, not meaning to be falsely modest or anything like that, but a regional writer in the sense I think that Faulkner was a regional writer in America. And my region is South Africa.
Do you feel constrained there at all by limitations of what will be allowed to be performed on stage?
I think I've become so used to living with that danger, with the danger of censorship, and in some ways the situation today is a lot easier than it was in the past. I mean, I had to contend with a South Africa that was much more authoritarian in terms of its control over the arts than is the case today, where the government has attempted to persuade the outside world that it's moving in a liberal direction by allowing certain things to take place in theatre and in the arts generally, which wasn't the case many years ago. So, you know, both that fact and, as I say, the fact that I've just grown up in that country and learned to survive under those sort of restrictions, I do not feel constrained. I've learned how to live with that.
Do you ever feel that if your work is not censored, then you're not doing your job?
Yes, there is the danger of a terrible sort of snobbery along those lines, you know, that if you haven't been banned or if your work hasn't been censored or, let's put it even crudely, if you haven't been to jail at least once or if you haven't been raided by the security police and searched in the early hours of the morning, you haven't actually earned your credentials. Unfortunately, yes, I think a little bit of that does operate back home.
What do you think is the power of theater or art in general to help topple the apartheid system? Do you think of art in those terms? Do you think of art as having an overt political function?
Well, it obviously does have that. For example, I heard a story about a South African who had had very, very strong traditional South African attitudes and who for some reason or the other had been at Yale when I was doing Master Harold, who had come along and had seen the play and who had been so affected by that production and who had in fact undergone a change of heart. Now, I have heard of quite a few cases like that in terms of responses to mine and other works of art, other to novels and things like that from South Africa. So one has got to reckon with the fact that apparently art can be as profoundly effective as that in terms of people.
You've had collaborative relationships with many black actors, and I'm sure that there are many obstacles in having that kind of relationship in a separatist country. Perhaps one of the first relationships you had like that was with Zakes Mokhai in The Blood Knot. Were there any obstacles in actually getting together and working together on the play and then afterwards on performing it?
Oh, yes. Well, firstly, I mean, just for Zakes and myself to get together as two actors and to go up onto a stage, that had never happened before in South Africa, that a black man and a white man had appeared on a stage, and a black actor or a white actor had appeared on a stage at the same time. We were the first in that regard, and all sorts of complications were attendant on that. I mean, in travelling around the country when we eventually took Blood Knot to different cities. Zakes had to travel third class because he had no other choice. I travelled first class. Life was very complicated. Zakes, on a point of principle, refused to carry his reference book. He wanted to make a political statement in his personal life. I knew that if we didn't have that book around with us, that we'd be in trouble. Zakes would be in jail and the show couldn't go on. So I carried the book for Zakes, and whenever the police stopped us, I presented it and pretended that Zakes was working for me, things like that. Yes, there have been lots of complications along those lines. When I collaborated with John Carney and Winston and Chawner to produce Sizwe Bonzi is Dead and The Island, there again, officialdom just couldn't cope with black men as actors. There was no precedent for that. So, as far as the sort of paper bureaucracy of South Africa is concerned, John Carney and Winston Chawner worked for me. John was a clerical employee and Winston was my chauffeur. You know, it's the only way we could get away with it.
Did that affect the relationship that you had with each other, since when officials asked, you had to be in the superior employer relationship?
No, you're quite right. Well, no, you learned to play those games as part of your survival mechanism in South Africa. I mean, you know, many, many times, in order to bail Zakes and myself out of a tight spot, for example, with the police, I would put on a heavy Afrikaner act and talk to the policeman as if I was a good Afrikaner and Zakes was my boy, my employee. And Zakes knew that I was doing it in order to, to keep the two of us out of jail. It was a survival mechanism.
You also, in the 1960s, were a co-founder of a group called the Serpent Theater, which was also integrated. What were some of the difficulties then of rehearsing together? Were you allowed into the black townships? Were they allowed into the white communities?
Well, Serpent Players were a group I worked with in my hometown of Port Elizabeth. And Port Elizabeth has always been a difficult area for me because the authorities there have consistently refused to allow me to go into the black ghetto areas, into the black townships. So in order to work with Serpent Players, we had to find a sort of neutral territory halfway between their black world and my white world, and in fact in one of the twilight zones in Port Elizabeth. And that is where we would get together and rehearse and meet. And I was faced with these sort of rather an unhappy situation where sometimes I would direct a play and not be able to attend performances of it because they took place in the sort of in the black township areas into which I was not allowed to go.
When you collaborate black and white together in a separatist system like South Africa, does the racial hatred that the system is built on necessarily infect personal relationships?
Well, you see, thank God for it, one of the incredible paradoxes of South Africa is that under a system which operates on the basis of ignorance and fear and hate and greed, that in spite of that system, men of different and women of different color can come together and work, you know, in a context of true love and respect. I mean, I would like to believe that that is the basis in terms of which Zakes Mokai and I have survived 20 years and are still together, working, celebrating. The basis in terms of which John Carney and Winston and Chawn and myself have worked in the past.
Your play Master Harold and the Boys is based in part on the relationship you had when you were young with a black man who was a waiter, I think, at a cafe that your mother ran. There's an incident in the play that I think is based on an incident in your life where the young white boy, who's the son of the mother who owns the cafe, who's really very close with the waiter, spits in his face. From what I understand, it was very difficult for you to write that part in. Can I ask about the personal significance that that event had for you?
Yes, that did happen. Tragically, regrettably, a moment of a cauterizing, traumatic moment of shame in my life that I still live with, that was there at a point in my childhood coming out of, I can remember the day, a spasm of bewilderment and confusion. I can't remember what had upset me so much that day, but I turned on the one person I had in my life, the one true friend I had, and he was a black man, and he worked for my family. He worked for my mother as a waiter in this little tea room we had. I spat in Sam's face. And the moment I had done it, I knew what I had done. A second after I had done it, I knew that I had most probably done one of the truly ugly things of my entire life. Even though I was only 13 years old, I knew that I was going to be very, very hard for me to ever equal the ugliness of what I had done, because, I mean, I had sullied, I had dirtied what was one of the most beautiful things I had in my life, was that friendship. And I've lived with that. I lived with that shame, and still do live with the shame of that act. And when it came to writing the play, I didn't write the play just for that reason, in an attempt to finally deal with that moment. I'd been trying to write about Sam and another man that worked for the family as well, also as a waiter, a man called Willie. I'd been trying to write about Sam and Willie for a long time in my life, just to celebrate them, because they were two very, very beautiful human beings and very instrumental, very important in me finally starting on a process of emancipation from the prejudices of my country, of the traditional South African way of life. And I just wanted to celebrate those two men. And when I finally put the little boy in there with him, I realized that I potentially had an opportunity to do both that and also deal with this unbelievably ugly thing that I had done. And in writing the play, I thought for a long time that my craft as a playwright would stand me in good stead, and that I would not necessarily have to sink so low as to actually have up there on stage a moment when the white boy spat in a black man's face. But the deeper I worked myself into the play, and the more I developed the play and wrote it, the more I realized that there was just no avoiding that moment. And one day, I just took it on. I opened the brackets and I wrote, "Hallie spits in Sam's face," and closed the brackets. And there it was.
Was that like a personal exorcism for you?
Yes, it was. I mean, to a large extent, I finally did deal with that moment. What I have gone on to realize, though, is that the stain of that moment remains. I mean, it is possible, unfortunately, or maybe that is what life's about, it is possible for you to stain your life so deeply that you can actually never wash it out. You know what I mean?
Is there a moment when you can point to and say, this is when I realized that the system of apartheid was evil, was unjust?
Yes. I mean, I knew it was the process of discovering that it was evil and unjust, that it maimed and mutilated people, destroyed them, was something that happened, you know, more or less from the time I spat in Sam's face. That was, but the full extent, the sort of the moment of certainty, the moment when I realized the extent of the of what that system was doing, came when I, for a variety of reasons, took on a job in Johannesburg, which was to be the clerk of a court, of a criminal court that sent, that tried black people for offences in terms of the passbook that they are compelled by law to carry. And it's when I sat in that courtroom 5 days a week for a period of about 6 months and watched a black man or woman, and sometimes a child, being disposed of at the rate of one every 3 minutes, being sent off to jail. When I saw that tidal wave of humanity being processed by this diabolical machine, that the full extent of what apartheid meant and does and was doing dawned on me, when it was brought home to me. Now, that was one of the, if I can talk about spitting in Sam's face as being the traumatic personal moment, that was the traumatic social moment. That was a moment in terms of my political conscience.
Was that about the time that you started writing plays also?
Yes, yes. That is, in fact, the period when my very first published play was written. I still think of it as an apprenticeship work, and it precedes The Blood Knot, a play called No Good Friday. It was also the first play that marks the first meeting with Zakes Mukai, who is in The Blood Knot with me.
I know one thing that drives a lot of white people who live in South Africa crazy is that every time you sit on a bench or board a bus or enter into certain stores, you are in a way making a complicit act with apartheid, if that is a segregated bench or bus or store. And I wonder how you reconcile that now.
One doesn't arrive at reconciliation in terms of that. I mean, the thing that you have to live with constantly in South Africa as a white South African who opposes the system is that even in opposing the system, even in doing what you can by way of writing plays or protesting or doing this, your daily life is still rotten with compromise. And you're involved in that very, very dangerous exercise of hoping that what you do at one level outweighs that, that the way you live, the fact that you live in a whites-only area among affluent white people, you hope that those compromises haven't irremediably stained or poisoned your life, that you somehow are still making some contribution towards an eventual decency in that society. It's a dangerous lifestyle. I mean, but there's no way of avoiding it other than to get out. And if I get out, how am I contributing to anything then? I still have got to believe that being inside that country, inside that society, even though I have to live with these compromises, that somehow I still contribute more by being inside and doing my thing than I would be by going into voluntary or enforced exile.
Do you feel that yourself and other white people who oppose apartheid end up feeling that they have to shoulder a lot of guilt for being there or for acts that may seem compromised from your youth before you gain the awareness that you have now?
Oh, that's very important. You really are touching on one of the major factors in the psychology of the white South African, is the operation, the presence of, the genesis of, the hoped-for elimination of guilt. Major, major factor. God knows, I think that, I lived with that as one of the most potent factors in my psychology. I'm, as I've said before, 53 years old now. I must admit that as I'm getting older now, I'm getting a bit tired of being guilty, of feeling guilty. And I'm beginning to ask myself, just how guilty am I? Haven't I, in fact, laid a lot of those guilts on myself? Am I as guilty as I thought I was? And, well, let me just leave it at that. Let me just say that I'm in the process of really addressing the question of my guilt. And that I think that possibly a lot of my writing in the some of my writing in the future might be an examination of that fact.
Do you have to ask yourself how productive guilt is at a certain point?
True guilt, the admission of true guilt, is very important and can only be productive. To act out of false guilt is stupid and pointless.
Your plays have been performed in South Africa and in America. I was thinking that American audiences might find it easier to give themselves over to your plays in that the kind of racism that is addressed in your plays is the kind of racism that exists in South Africa. And what I'm saying here is that I think American racism is a more covert kind of racism than the apartheid kind, and because it's happening over there and we are not directly implicated in it, it's easier to perhaps not internalize some of the statements that you're making within your plays.
Yes, very interesting. You are absolutely right. I mean, I would go along with what you have just said 100%. It's very interesting, actually, to sort of examine in what respects racism in the two countries, racism in South Africa and America, are similar and dissimilar. The way racism in South Africa, because it is institutionalized, because it is, in a sense, the system, it is built into the system, the way, in a sense, it frees the individual of having to, you know what I mean, is South Africa has never produced a lynch party. You get my point? The lynch mob is something unknown in South Africa for the simple reason our system does it for us. Our system hangs them. We don't have to get together as a mob and go out after the black man.
How do you think the South African government regards you now?
Oh God, I don't know. What a small little thorn in the side. I mean, I'm a source of intense irritation to them, I think. I don't think they see me as... They might have at one time, but they don't any longer, I think, see me as a real danger. The days when an old-style liberal like myself, like Alan Paton, like Nadine Gordimer, the days when liberal writers like us were sort of regarded as significant public enemies, those days are past. I mean, they are having to deal with people now who are committed to real violence. They know that I'm not going to make a bomb. It would be a violation of my nature and what I believe in to make a bomb. They are dealing with people who are making bombs.
I know that there are some black South African exiles living in America who think that in a way you could be used as almost a goodwill ambassador of South Africa because it might make them look good to say, well, look, we have an artist, a critic like Ethel Fugard who's allowed to travel freely. How bad could we be?
Oh, I know that there are there's a very strong opinion amongst South Africans in exile, amongst black South Africans in exile, who regard my existence, my presence and my work as highly suspect, and in fact counterproductive of the cause. I mean, they even take exception to the content of my plays. They say that a character like Sam, for example, in Master Harold in The Boys, who displays compassion and forgiveness finally when that white boy spits in his face. They would have preferred it if I'd written a man who had turned on that white boy and beaten the living daylights out of him, because that would have been a warning to the world that, listen, we black people are not going to be spat at anymore. They regard my Sam as a danger. There's nothing I can do about that. I can only be the man I am, live the life that I have to live.
How much more violent do you think it's going to get in South Africa?
I think it's going to get a lot worse. I think we've just seen the start of the trouble.
I ask you this because I figure you must think about it, but what do you think the chances are that apartheid will end in the near future?
The Afrikaner government in South Africa is so powerful, it's got so much on its side, that the near future is almost wishful thinking. That it is going to change, that one day there will eventually be a decent society in South Africa, that I do passionately believe. I think we'll be fooling ourselves if we hope for that next year or the year after. Tragically, I think a lot more blood has got to be spilt, a lot more lives are going to be lost before that happens.
Are there any white liberals who fear change in a way because the distinction might not be made between whites who have opposed the system and whites who have supported it?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, you'd be guilty of the most incredible naive thought process if you're going to live in that country as a liberal and think that an exception is going to be made by the black mob when they happen to come along and find you in their way. There is no way that the violence we are heading for in South Africa now is going to allow for the distinction between a good white and a bad white. You're going to get it like everybody else.
Is there a time that you have in your mind when you think you would actually leave South Africa, if things reached a certain point?
I would never leave South Africa. I'd like to believe I would never leave South Africa. But in making that decision, I mean, I sort of commit my wife to it as well. I haven't quite resolved that one for myself yet.
That was South African playwright, director, and actor Ethel Fugard. Ethel Fugard's plays include The Blood Knot, Sizwe Banzwe is Dead, A Lesson from Aloes, and Master Harold and the Boys. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineer for this edition was Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview or for a listing of other Fresh Air programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. The number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.